I'm here with Martin Palicki, the publisher of InPark Magazine. Hello, Martin.
Hey, Philip. Hey, I've got a question for you. What do Abraham Lincoln, West Side Story, and the AIDS epidemic all have in common?
I'm not sure, but I'm guessing it's something to do with theater.
That's a good guess, but not quite. It's not going to be that easy, but I will give you a big hint. They are connected in some way to the Ravinia Music Festival in Highland Park, Illinois.
What is it? I'm super curious, but I just realized we need to do the credits first, right? That's how this whole thing works.
Yes, let's start with the credits. Go ahead.
Well, I'm your host, Philip Hernandez, and from the editors of InPark Magazine, the global publication serving the theme entertainment industry, this is InPark Tracks. Tell me a little bit more about this.
So Ravinia is a huge outdoor concert venue located in the suburbs of Chicago, which is actually not far from where I grew up. On the site, they have several small performance venues and a very large 3,000-seat pavilion. Every night during the summer months, they put on different concerts, and the artists range from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra to, well, this year they've had Ben Folds, Ms. Lauryn Hill, John Legend, and even the Beach Boys.
Wow, that's quite a lineup.
It's an eclectic array of musical artists, for sure. It tends to skew a little bit classical, though. I mean, what you would expect older donors with money might want to hear. But as I've learned recently, and that we're going to talk about soon, they've been working hard to diversify their audience and broaden their appeal.
Well, that is important for any guest-centric venue.
Exactly. I should probably add a little footnote here that Ravinia does a ton of work with the local community in terms of music outreach, education, and inclusion, which we also will talk about later. But when most people hear the word Ravinia, they think of taking in a concert and the expansive outdoor lawn section.
Ooh, tell me more.
It's great. You know, you grab a group of friends, grab a blanket, a bottle of wine, some cheese and crackers, and you just enjoy the evening listening to the live music through their great sound system. It's, I would say it's a magical environment that really appeals to all of your senses. You feel the blades of grass beneath your toes, and at night, the trees are all uplit and they're really beautiful. The air filled with the smell of citronella candles. And of course, the wine is flowing throughout the night. So, and above all of this, right, the music just kind of floats. So that's sort of the scene every night at Ravinia. Can you picture it?
Yeah, I think I'm getting it. And I think my senses are quite tickled.
Well, that's the whole point. And that's actually what the Ravinia experience has been. For decades, but now that's changed. Starting in the summer of 2021, they introduced the Ravinia Music Box Theater, which is a brand new theatrical experience that's been in development for about 15 years that on many levels you would think would be more at home at a theme park or a modern museum.
So what is that type of experience doing at the concert venue?
I'm glad you asked, Philip, because I wondered the same thing. I actually went to check it out during a recent media preview. And to start the story, we have to go all the way back to 2005. So Wells Kaufman, who was Ravinia's CEO at the time, and he was a CEO up through 2020, he really shepherded the process along while he was at the park. So here he is. We have him explaining the project's genesis during a panel discussion at that preview. I should probably note, this took place outside. It was a rainy day. There were fans blowing and people taking pictures and forklifts backing up and beeping. So it's a little bit noisy, but he really has an intense and great story.
So I started working here in the fall of 2000 and was struggling with a way to try to figure out how to get to know and engage this extraordinary animal that we call the Ravinia family, which is our trustees, life trustees, women's board, associates board, and staff, 400 people in all. And how do you get to know them and what's going to engage them in terms of discussion? And there were lots of things that I wanted to talk about that might happen at Ravinia, and I assumed and assumed correctly, which I don't always do, that they would also have a lot of things to talk about. The thing that kept surfacing was, we're all so concerned about classical music audiences. Where are the next ones going to come from? Why is there a struggle, seemingly worldwide, to build audiences? Where are the answers? Why have we gotten to this place when it seemed like, as recently as the 80s, everything was really, really go-go? So we started looking at that, kind of analyzing those kinds of things, a little wonky, a little nerdy. I'm a little wonky, a little nerdy, so that made sense. But what's really key to this was that these various groups of the family that I mentioned had never really been together and interacted with each other. They did things separately. They raised money. They encouraged their own membership. They did projects. They did parties, all sorts of things like that. But this was a chance to bring them together. And it was about 5 years of these kinds of discussions, which I was trying to tally it up. Some way or another, this was happening once a week. And every time it would happen, if we were talking about something as mundane as parking or traffic or the parking lot's flooding or food and beverage or any number of things, the idea of what are we going to do about audience? How do we make Ravinia really feel like a welcoming, inviting, inclusive, and not so exclusive big tent? And that big tent visual was something we kept coming back to. So I don't want you to think that there was like three meetings where we all were together and came up with this idea. That's not how it worked. But along the way, we were talking about improvements to the physical plants, how to increase audiences for everything that we were doing, how to increase more diverse audiences. Very importantly for the associates board, the junior board, they wanted to know, when did Ravinia kind of get a little sleepy around the non-classical side of the performancers that they would bring? When the 60s and 70s, which most of the associates were not even born yet when that happened, had been Janis Joplin and Tina Turner and Jesus Christ Superstar and all these kinds of wild, wonderful things, Carpenters, Linda Ronstadt, all kinds of things. And could we get that back? Could we get that mojo back so that the non-classical side of what Ravinia presented started to move toward the high quality of the classical side, beginning with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Yo-Yo Ma and Kerry Tsukanawa and Long Long and Dudamel and everything else that was happening at the time. So those discussions continued to happen. I knew I wanted to do something around the Lincoln Bicentennial, and I know this seems like a tangent, in 2008, mostly because my brother's name is Lincoln and he insisted that I do this, but also because we're in Illinois. So we should do something, if we could figure out a way to do something artsy around Lincoln. I joined the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission in Springfield. The meetings were in Springfield every other month. I put the dog in the car, drive down there, and one day, in I think 2005 or six, they said, would you like to see the new Abraham Lincoln Museum? And I said, sure. So I go through it and I was completely dazzled. In my own sense of ego and hubris, I thought I knew everything about Lincoln. I'd read a lot of books. But this experience of walking through this and being entertained by it and being sort of subsumed with information and things that I didn't know about such an exalted figure that so many Americans think they know everything about, got me to think, boy, who are these people that created this? And could they do that for Brahms or for Bach or for Beethoven?
So thanks to his visit to the Lincoln Museum, Wells gets connected with BRC, who we in the theme entertainment industry know quite well.
Oh, yes, BRC. They worked on Mystery Lodge at Knott's Berry Farm, the NASA shuttle launch experience, and the Henry Ford Museum, right?
Exactly, as well as a number of World's Fair pavilions through the years. And of course, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois, that we're talking about here and that Wells just mentioned. So this is really the critical part of the story, because that singular experience at the Lincoln Museum is what brought together this essentially classical music concert venue and this themed entertainment company, and brought them together to create a brand new kind of immersive theater in a venue that's like totally new to this type of experience.
So it's more about the pairing of the two?
Yes, the experience is special, and we'll get into more of that later. But what's really remarkable is the placement of this themed entertainment experience in an outdoor concert venue.
So it opens up a whole new marketplace for LBE experiences.
Exactly. So anyway, Wells gets connected to BRC's creative directors, Brad Shelton and Edward Hodge, whom we'll hear from later, and they start working on the concept. So here's Wells again.
What I found out with BRC is that part of their magic that I experienced with Lincoln was that they're storytellers. They're dramatists. But another thing they said to me was the bookstore at the Abraham Lincoln Museum and Library in Springfield, people were leaving these experiences that they'd had that BRC had created and going and buying books and learning more. That really turned me on as well. We started doing a lot of work together. One of the highlights was we rented a little shuttle bus, took about 40 trustees down to Springfield. All of them kind of complaining the whole way because they were Illinois people. They knew about Lincoln. Why were we going to Springfield? I want to play golf. It's a Saturday. What's happening? And they were completely blown away by what that experience was. And the fact that they were people who were literally reciting the Emancipation Proclamation in the bus on the way down to make me really realize how much they knew. The idea of trying to translate that historical figure to musical historical figures into music started to take shape. But I wanted to take you back to the family, because at the end of the day, none of us would be here. if the Ravinia family hadn't, with both feet, jumped in and said, this is something we want to do because we know that when we have a huge non-classical show, people get here 3-4 hours before the performance begins. So they have something to eat. They see their friends. They go to the restroom. They still have 3 hours. They go to the gift shop. They still have 2.5 hours. How could we give them an experience that they could bump into, literally classical music wise? And that's the end result.
The end result. I'm still not quite sure what this experience is all about, though.
Actually, at this point, I don't think Wells really knew either. He was connected with BRC and knew he wanted to create an experience where people attending a pop concert could, as he just said, bump into classical music. But he needed a focus or an icon. So earlier he mentioned Brahms and Beethoven, but I think what he and Ravinia needed was someone else, someone who could bridge the gap between Benz Folds and Bach. And I think actually Wells knew exactly the guy that he wanted. The genius composer and conductor, perhaps most famously known for his musical masterpiece, West Side Story, the one and only Leonard Bernstein.
Why Leonard Bernstein? Because in many ways, though he didn't have a lot of time at Ravinia in the 40s, he was here, but you know, the New York Philharmonic took over, Europe took over, composing took over, all these kinds of things. But as a conductor, pianist, someone very engaged with his time, whether it be civil rights or gay rights or AIDS or Vietnam or whatever it might be, but someone who really lived in his time, and a lot of classical musicians tend to be a little cocooned, a little ivory tower. Great composer as well, great pianist, and great educator at the end of the day. Right? Those young people's concerts that many of us grew up with, or know even now because they're back in full form and they're just as vibrant today as they were then. Maybe he would be the model, because in many ways, with Ravinia's education programs and the different kinds of musics that he loved, jazz and musical theater and Mahler, that was being explored here at Ravinia in a big way, maybe there was a nice mirroring that could go on, and that's where we would go. Then we started to involve Marin Alsop, who I wanted to be the person that would curate our Leonard Bernstein celebration for his 100th birthday in 2018, great friend of the family, final protege, only female protege of Leonard Bernstein's. And then we started to involve the family and the Leonard Bernstein organization, especially Paul Epstein and Jamie, as they were gearing up for the centennial and what that would be. They let me coordinate and corral a bunch of colleagues in the arts here in Chicago to be a committee that would think about the Bernstein centennial in Chicago. They'd already done this in LA and New York and a bunch of other places. And this is when we started to kind of eke out what the music box might look and feel like, even though that piece of the process was, again, its own journey.
Okay, I still don't understand what the experience is like.
I know, Philip, we are almost there. Now we have the initial mission for the project. We have the creative team paired with the project developer, and we have a thematic focus for the experience. Who, by the way, is the answer to my question for you?
Oh, right. What do Abraham Lincoln, West Side Story, and the AIDS epidemic have in common?
Yes, the answer is, of course, Leonard Bernstein. So, it all comes together, right? But what the actual theatrical experience is like, and the design and technology that helped make it happen, is actually going to be the focus of our episode next week. So you're going to have to stay tuned.
Wait, this is a multi-part episode?
It is. It's one of three.
One of three? So we'll be back next week with part two? Okay.
We'll be back with part two. Like I said, talking about the experience and behind the scenes that helped make it a reality.
This has been In Park Tracks, the audio companion to In Park Magazine. For more information and to sign up for a free subscription, visit imparkmagazine.com/subscribe. In Park Tracks is a production of In Park Magazine. Our executive producers are Philip Hernandez and Martin Pilecki. This episode was edited by me, with post-production by David Swope, and music by Ravinia Jazz Scholars and Martin Landstrom. The In Park staff includes Judith Rubin, Joe Kleiman, and Jordan Suha.